The hotels are full, and people are in the campgrounds and in the rest stop areas and making do as best they can.
Travelers waited out on the Alaska Highway. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 11th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the Coast Guard in Sitka finds big savings in its monthly energy bill.
These guys didn't have a clue what their energy consumption was. They just did it, and someone far, far away paid the bill.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Efforts continue to secure the leaking fuel tanks of the U.S. Army Reserve landing craft Monterey, which was intentionally grounded late Friday night after hitting a charted rock just offshore downtown Kodiak. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation has revised downward the amount of diesel fuel reported by the Coast Guard as spilled. Stephen Russell, the state on-scene coordinator, estimates between 8 and 12,000 gallons spilled. Russell says an extensive effort was made to determine if any marine life or seabirds were harmed by the diesel spill, but none were found.
Coast Guard was out looking about, and state parks was looking in the Bushkin River area. I believe the Kodiak Island Borough was out as well. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service did a survey of the entire area this morning, and they're not reporting any impaired wildlife at all.
The aroma of diesel was strong, and a rainbow sheen of fuel was widely visible on the Kodiak waterfront all weekend. Russell said skimmers are being used near the Monterey, and sorbent pads are being used to sop up concentrations of fuel. He says there are no plans to burn off or use dispersants on the fuel. Oil booms were also placed at the mouth of the nearby Bushkin River to protect salmon spawning habitat. The Monterey will remain grounded on Puffin Island and surrounded by floating oil booms until the damaged tanks are empty and the ship's stability can be assured. According to Major Anne-Marie Daneker of the U.S. Army Reserve, officials are still deciding how to get the cargo of construction equipment to its destination near Newtok on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta coast.
Once they get to the pier, they will take the equipment off of there, and then further discussion will be made whether they're actually going to continue the journey up to Bethel to support the IRT mission, or perhaps if that's not an option, then they could find something maybe in Kodiak where they can use that equipment up there before they return it back to Port Hueneme. Of course, with Alaska's short summers, we're kind of limited to the time that we can complete that mission.
Three crewmen suffered bumps and bruises when the Monterey hit Humpback Rock and were taken ashore for medical attention. They were treated and released and are reported in good condition. Parts of the Alaska Highway in Canada remained closed today, stranding travelers and supplies in the Yukon and near the communities of Haines and Skagway. The road isn't likely to open until at least tomorrow. Margaret Friedenauer from KHNS has more.
Heavy rains and snowmelt caused mudslides that closed the road on Friday and for part of the weekend between Destruction Bay and Haines Junction, Yukon, between Teslin and Watson Lake, Yukon, and on parts of the South Klondike Highway between Skagway and Whitehorse. On Monday, the stretch of road between Teslin and Watson Lake remained closed. Stores in Whitehorse began running low on supplies over the weekend, and the city used aircraft to ferry in perishable food. The government was also assisting residents in the Liard River Basin near Watson Lake, whose homes flooded due to the rising river. Mac Hislop of Travel Yukon, the tourism arm of the government in the territory, went to Watson Lake to help assist at the public information office there.
There's certainly a lot of
traffic in Watson Lake, and we have established a public information office there to get information out to the people, the traveling public, and the residents, just to keep them informed of what's going on.
The government also set up an emergency FM transmitter, and social service teams help displaced residents and travelers. Hislop said the Watson Lake community is dealing the best it can with the extra guests, many of whom are traveling to or from Alaska.
You know, we've had about 500 people or so coming into the public information office over the weekend. The estimate is there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,000 people in the community. So the hotels are full, and people are in the campgrounds and in the rest stop areas and making do as best they can.
He said road crews are working to put in a one-lane detour around the washed-out section of road. Once the detour opens, officials said they plan to allow a controlled release of fuel and supply trucks to go through first.
What they'll be doing is prioritizing the release of traffic so that the trucks, transport trucks carrying critical supplies, fuel, food, that sort of thing, will go through first. Then there'll be a delay of travelers through.
The road between Haines Junction and Destruction Bay opened again on Saturday, although Yukon Highway officials said the road could close again if the area gets more rain. The South Klondike Highway opened again late Saturday also. The road had closed between the Yukon communities of Carcross and Fraser on Friday, shutting Skagway off from Whitehorse. But some travelers and residents took advantage of the White Pass Yukon Route Railroad to bypass the road closure. The railroad normally offers sightseeing excursions between Skagway and Carcross, but over the weekend the company changed its schedule to accommodate cruise passengers and travelers stuck in Skagway, said marketing manager Allison Haas.
It's kind of nice when things go wrong, as they can do in the north with Mother Nature. It's nice to be able to assist everyone else who was just trying to get back to work in Whitehorse or vice versa if they had gone up from Skagway for the day and needed to get back. It's nice to be able to help them out and not just be a tourist railroad for the day.
Haines and Skagway fuel and food supplies were not affected by the road closures because both communities receive most of their goods on weekly barge deliveries. While the Alaska Highway is the main route between interior Alaska and Canada, the longer and less traveled top of the world highway between Dawson City, Yukon, and Tok remained open and in good condition. Reporting from Haines, this is Margaret Friednauer.
The Alaska Highway closure has interrupted more than just summer tourists. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, some grocery shoppers in interior Alaska are feeling the effects.
Fred Meyer East store director David Atlee says the mudslides and washouts on several stretches of the Alaska Highway last week blocked the refrigerated tractor trailer rigs from bringing produce into Alaska over the past couple of days.
Some of the product there that we were waiting on the delivery, we just don't have.
Delta IGA food cash owner Ed Larson says grocers in the interior depend on those trucks to bring the twice weekly shipments of fresh produce from Washington State and points south over the Alaska Highway. But because the trucks couldn't get through, Sunday shoppers had to make do with less, not bare shelves, just less variety. Both Atlee and Larson say the shortage won't lead them to raise prices. Larson says if the road isn't opened Monday, he may order produce shipped by sea into the port at Anchorage and then brought by train to Fairbanks, then transported by truck from there. If that becomes necessary, shoppers may have to deal with less produce for a few more days. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, you've heard of Woodstock, now there's Chicken Stock, complete with festive costumes.
I am dressed as the deviled egg with an egg yolk, the long devil tail, and the horns.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
The North Pacific Fishery Management Council voted on Friday to reduce halibut bycatch in the Gulf of Alaska by 15%, the maximum amount under consideration during its meeting in Kodiak. The cuts to the trawl and longline fleets will be phased in over 3 years. The reduction passed on a 10-1 vote, with Dave Benson of Washington State dissenting. Teresa Peterson is a commercial fisherman in Kodiak who works with the Alaska Marine Conservation Council and has followed the deliberations closely.
Our sense is that this is an important action and very responsive to the concerns with bycatch in the Gulf. I think it illustrates how important responsible use of our resources in Alaska waters are, and how many people are willing to get engaged to make sure Alaska remains the world-class fisheries that we have today.
The next step in the process is for the council to determine how to go about implementing the bycatch reductions. In the Bering Sea trawl fisheries, the bycatch is largely salmon, and recently the non-targeted fish are being retained for the benefit of food banks, but Peterson says it's a slightly different situation in the Gulf of Alaska with halibut.
The halibut that are caught as bycatch primarily in the trawl fishery are pretty small, so I think it's more important at this juncture to try to leave more of those small fish in the water so that they can contribute to the future spawning biomass.
Over 2.5 days, much of the testimony before the council urged a reduction of 15%. Huge cuts to both the commercial and charter halibut quotas in recent years prompted a strange bedfellow alliance among the traditionally competing user groups and generated much of the comments. The cut of nearly 700,000 pounds will be made to the 4.5 million pound bycatch cap put in place nearly 25 years ago. The council continues its meeting through tomorrow. The Dillingham City Council has been updated about a large bag of contaminated dirt that is missing somewhere in the Nooshkak River. Last November, a barge company mishandled the bag during a transfer from one barge to another at the Dillingham City Dock, and an effort to find it last week was unsuccessful. KDLG's Mike Mason reports.
The bag, which contains thousands of pounds of PCB-contaminated dirt, ended up in the Nooshkak River. Because of ice and other concerns, the bag was left in place with plans to retrieve it in the spring. The Dillingham City Council received an update on the retrieval project during their meeting Thursday night. Pat Roth is with the U.S. Air Force. He's the program manager for a large cleanup project in Port Hyden to clean up contaminated soil from an old Air Force radio relay station. The bag of contaminated dirt that ended up in the Nooshkak River off of Dillingham was part of that cleanup project. Roth reported that they have exhausted the areas where they can get good sonar readings and have basically called off the search for the super sack.
We don't know where it is. We know where it's not. So what moved the sack? Was it just the current? Did the ice come in and push it out of the way? Did the colder than normal winter this year freeze down and literally then pick up the sack when the ice went out? We don't know.
Roth announced that the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation has now turned the matter over to the EPA Enforcement Division, and he was unsure what the EPA would do next. The agency could issue a fine or even go so far as to require monitoring for PCBs or mandate another search for the super sack in the river. There is a chance the super sack is still intact because it was double-lined and Teflon-coated, which makes it quite strong. The sack contains about 11,000 pounds of soil contaminated with PCBs, which are man-made compounds that were used in electrical equipment such as transformers and capacitors. Their use was banned by Congress back in 1979 because in large concentrations, they've been linked to cancer. Dillingham City Councilman Tim Sands is not worried that the salmon that are returning to the Nooshkak and Wood Rivers will be contaminated, but he says there are other considerations at play.
Biologically, the fish just got here, so it's not like they've been feeding in the bay. And so I don't think there's a problem with contamination from PCBs, but there is an image problem. If people think that their fish are being caught in this, I mean, my wife teaches sixth grade, and her students were asking her questions and concerned about this issue.
Right.
So the perception's out there, and it's not good for marketing.
Several members of the Dillingham City Council spoke about the super sack issue late in Thursday night's meeting, including Keggy Tubbs, who agreed that it is not good for public perception.
Having Alaska Logistics or whoever is responsible for this fiasco, the least they can do is pay for testing to try and set the public's mind at ease. And that's what I would prefer we pursue. The results may come back negative and whatnot, but it's beyond just a negative result. It's, like I say, putting the public's mind at ease, not just here, but industry-wide.
After a few minutes of discussion, the Dillingham City Council asked the city manager to contact the state and federal regulators to stay abreast of the situation and to see if there is anything that can be done to counter the public perception issues brought up by several council members. The Air Force officials in attendance for Thursday night's meeting stressed that they will keep the city up to date about any additional efforts to find the Super Sac or to conduct testing in the area for PCBs. The Super Sac was dropped in the Nooshigak River on November 4th, and it's been missing ever since. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The U.S. Coast Guard Air Station in Sitka is abandoning oil as a heat source. Work will start in the next week on a new heating system that uses wood pellets instead of oil. As KCAW's Ed Ronco reports, it's part of an effort to make the Coast Guard more energy efficient.
For years now, the Coast Guard has used oil for heat. They say that the technology is tried and true and that oil is easy to handle and relatively easy to obtain. So why make the switch to wood pellets?
Simple answer, money.
Bob Deering is the environmental and engineering manager for the Coast Guard's civil engineering unit in Juneau. Now, okay, bear with us because here come some numbers.
The air station burns about 85,000 gallons of heating oil each year. And so you can calculate the cost based on that. But we're paying in excess of $4 a gallon for heating oil.
So let me get out my calculator here. 85,000 gallons times a minimum price of $4 per gallon equals at least $340,000 per year, just for heat at Air Station Sitka. Compare that to pellets, which Deering estimates will run about $300 per ton.
A ton of pellets is equal to about 115 gallons of heating oil. As far as the energy output.
So just a little more math now. 115 gallons of heating oil would cost at least $460. Now compare that to the roughly $300 for the same energy out of wood, and you get about a 35% savings. In other words, by making the switch, the Coast Guard reduces its heating bill by more than a third. At the same time, the Coast Guard is also performing an energy audit. They are looking at how they use energy now and what else they might do to save money. Deering says there have been some major revelations.
For instance, over at our cutter, the Maples Moorings, we know that the parking area around that building has got enough lighting to probably do brain surgery in, and that needs to be changed.
I think the Coast Guard's taken a very proactive approach in energy management.
Chris Bruton runs Sitka's electric department.
The billing cycle for the Coast Guard payment doesn't actually go to the units. It goes to the Coast Guard Finance Center in Chesapeake, Virginia. These guys didn't have a clue what their energy consumption was. They just did it, and someone far, far away paid the bill.
So about a year ago, the electric department started sending the unit commanders courtesy copies of their bill so that they can see how much energy they're using. Among the electric department's industrial customers, the Coast Guard is in the top five. Their efforts to become more efficient could make a significant difference for Sitka, and Bruton says they're certainly setting a good example as the city works to promote greater energy conservation among residents. Sitka began offering rebates for energy-efficient appliances, and there are a number of statewide programs doing much of the same. All of it fits into a larger picture of a city trying to save power. Bruton hopes doing so, saving power, will cut down on the need to run backup diesel generators, which cost the city about $1 million last year.
That's $1 million of value that's left this island forever. It's gone. $1 million of our income and our wages have left the town forever. And that's what we want to avoid. So a little bit of sacrifice by everybody will make a big difference.
The Coast Guard, meanwhile, is going to begin work on its wood pellet boilers in the near future with the goal of completing the project before the end of summer. It hopes to replicate the work at its installations in Ketchikan and Kodiak as well. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com.
A group of Alaska Natives is suing the State Division of Elections. The group includes Vicki Otte, CEO of MTNT, the McGrath Area Alaska Native Corporation, and Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation CEO Robin Samuelson. The plaintiffs allege that the State Division of Elections is going ahead with election preparations before federal authorities have given the okay to the Alaska redistricting plan. Native American Rights Fund attorney Natalie Landreth represents the plaintiffs.
The Division of Elections has started using the amended proclamation plan without yet having any kind of approval from the DOJ, essentially sending the train down the tracks, and we may not be able to stop it later. So it was important to come in at the very beginning and say, no, you cannot conduct candidate qualifying, you cannot close the list of candidates, you cannot certify candidates, and you certainly can't assign voters to new districts unless and until you have that approval.
In late May, the Alaska Redistricting Board submitted its amended proclamation plan to the Federal Justice Department for pre-clearance under the Voting Rights Act. Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act requires pre-clearance by the Justice Department to ensure that the changes will not result in discrimination against racial minorities. Landreth says as of this afternoon, the case has been handed over to a 3-judge panel.
It's already been assigned to what's called a 3-judge panel, which will be 2 district court judges and 1 Ninth Circuit judge. We don't know who they are yet, but it has been assigned to a panel today.
Alaska Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell and Division of Elections Director Gail Fanumiai are named in the suit. Gail Fanumiai.
They're trying to have the judge grant a temporary restraining order, which would prevent the division from continuing any preparatory needs that need to be done in order to conduct the August 28th primary timely, and then also requesting a preliminary injunction be granted to stop the division from doing any preparatory work until preclearance is received.
Fanumiai says oral arguments are set regarding the temporary restraining order for Thursday morning. Alaska Senator Mark Begich has introduced a measure that could benefit educators, public safety officers, and medical providers in rural communities. KDLG's Ariel Van Cleve explains.
The proposal would authorize the Secretary of Agriculture to distribute $50 million in loan guarantees and grants for housing. Spokesperson Julie Haskett says the measure does not currently have formal sponsors, but believes there will be interest from other lawmakers.
This is something that Senator Begich believes a lot of other rural senators will find interesting, other states who have large rural populations. We always know that Alaska has uniquely rural with our so many roadless communities and real severe isolation in some aspects. But there are other senators in western states and other states who have these rural populations. And we'll give them all a chance to review it and see where it goes.
According to the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's 2009 housing assessment, there are approximately 9,000 housing units needed in rural Alaska alone. Haskett says there has been a lot of support for this proposal from organizations in the state, such as the Tanana Chiefs Conference and the Association of Village Council Presidents Regional Housing Authority.
So we're trying to find a way to fund loan guarantees and grants so we can build housing or modernize housing or renovate housing. Because, you know, when you have solid housing and stable housing, you're much more likely to want to stay somewhere. and work somewhere, as opposed to if you're wondering if you're going to have a roof over your head.
She says this proposal could ensure people in rural communities will have access to much-needed teachers and health care providers. The measure was filed this week and gives priority in applying for projects to state and local education service agencies and housing authorities, as well as Indian tribes, tribal organizations, and tribally designated housing entities. In Dillingham, I'm Ariel Van Cleve.
Nearly 500 people gathered over the weekend for the Chickenstock Music Festival. The festival takes place in the tiny community of Chicken, 80 miles north of Tok. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, it's the sixth year in a row the festival has drawn a crowd from Alaska, the Yukon Territory, and beyond.
Tourists often stop into Chicken for a snack and a souvenir as they travel up and down the Taylor Highway. For one weekend in June, little blue and orange tents dot the hillside and fill the parking lot.
My name is Josie Busby, and I am basically put the festival on from start to finish. Chicken's always been a funny destination for visitors from around the state and outside and worldwide, actually.
Busby and the event staff wear red and yellow tie-dyed t-shirts. Most wear hats shaped like chickens, and some even dress as eggs.
My name is Robert Saragosa. I'm the cook here at Chickenstock. We run a little thing around here where four people are dressed as a chicken and two are as an egg. I am dressed as the deviled egg with an egg yolk, the long devil tail, and the horns.
The stage looks something like a musical shadow box. Two antique flatbed trucks are backed against each other. On top rests a huge wooden box. Inside, bands play for the small crowd that gathers below. For more than a century, gold mining has brought many people to Chicken, including singer-songwriter J. Peter Bowles.
Just the letter J and Peter Bowles. And
you have been playing music in Chicken for 30 years.
That's the original campfire music. Our campground was a gathering place. It was sort of like an unofficial coffee house, where all the old timers and the young guys from up the hill would come down, and they'd be in our camp every night, it seemed.
Chicken jokes abound in the tiny community where the year-round population tops out somewhere near 10. And the festival wouldn't be complete without a little dancing. Reporting from Chicken, I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, Tim Ellis in Delta, Mike Mason and Ariel Van Cleve in Dillingham, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Emily Schwing in Chicken. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Someone you know is likely a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans, mhtrust.org. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers loans tailored for first-time homebuyers, plus home choice education seminars that can help determine if a mortgage would be less than rent. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.